What's up, heroes? Welcome to episode 44 of the Producer Life podcast. This is part two of my interview with Chris Michaels, otherwise known as Cryptochronica. Cryptochronica is Chris's glitch fusion project, which blends genre and style into a glitchy bass fabric of funk, soul, rock, reggae, hip-hop, and down-tempo, all mixed together with heavy bass styles of the underground. Most recently, Chris was included on the Animalia EP from the Producer Dojo, which was curated by none other than Kermode. The EP charted number two on Beatport in Left Field Bass. Additionally, Chris is a sensei at the Producer Dojo and an amazing teacher, so if you missed part one, please go back and listen to episode 43 first. Today we talk about his remix process, why rules can be important, and why more producers should beatbox.
If you don't beatbox when you produce music, I encourage you to learn just a few basic things to do that. Just boots and cats, bro. Boots and cats is going to help you.
But first, cue the intro music. Tell me about your remix process.
Oh, that's a great question. I would love to, if I can get the stems, I basically remake their song with my sounds. I will break down every single piece of their, I will deconstruct their entire song. So I'll remake their kick channel, I'll remake their snare, I'll remake all of that, but using my own samples. And I'm not just picking a cymatics kick and putting a cymatics kick over where their kick would be. That's not how I do my production at all. I'm a big fan of, I'm a really big fan of deep layering. So I will create, like, for a single kick, it'll be like maybe six or seven different channels to comprise a single sound. And each of those channels of the kick will vary from one kick to the next. Maybe there's a little bit of a vinyl flutter. Maybe there's a little bit of AC hum. Maybe there's a different kind of kick body. Maybe there's a different type of kick beater sound in each kick, so that every single kick feels ever so slightly variable from the kick prior and the kick following it. So I'm not just taking a single sample and replacing their stems with my, you know, packaged out of the box splice sample or anything like that. And nothing wrong with that. If that is what you do, by all means, if it works for you, go for it. I like to take a lot of control over my music. I make sure that I try and make sure that every single thing feels like me, which, as I'm sure you can imagine, I am a bit of a control freak. I'll happily admit that. But I find that the overall product continues in creating this consistency like I was talking about. So the very first thing I'll do in remixing is I will break down every stem that they have and replace it with samples that I want. And then I will usually play with the beat structure and the groove, by which I mean that I will play with variations of the beat structure and the groove. So I'm a very avid beatboxer. If you don't beatbox when you produce music, I encourage you to learn just a few basic things to do that. Just boots and cats, bro. Boots and cats is going to help you be able to identify fills and groove really quickly. So say their beat is something like, say it's something like that. I might try a variation of the beat where it's like, and I might just try and play around with something like that. So normally I will play first with sample selection, switch out the samples, get their song completely recorded using my sounds. And then I will play with the groove and find an alternative groove that similarly works with their lead and their face. I usually leave their face if it's a vocal thing, or if it's a, usually if it's a vocal thing, I'll leave their face completely alone. They have spent all the work that they needed to get that voice singing exactly as that voice is going to sing. If that's the face of the song, I don't want to tamper with that, because that's going to be the identifying feature that people recognize when they re-listen to this song. So I want there to still be a Cryptochronica consistency with my own songs, but I also want there to be a consistency with the original, so that way we can recognize that song.
Just to clarify for my listeners, when you say face, you're talking about the Ilgates concept of, hey, this is sort of the core defining feature of that particular song. And that's what you try to leave alone.
Yes, for sure. So if we were going to, there's so many examples, but just like Ilgates is always saying, most people only hear two aspects when they listen to music. They hear what is called the foreground or the background, or what is otherwise called is the band and the singer. So even in dubstep music, you might not have a vocal. You might, your singer might be a bass line. That bass line might be something like wah, 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 pew, ba, boom, boom. That might be the face, otherwise known as the singer of that particular song. So if there's a really clear face in a song, say I'm doing a Norah Jones remix, I'm not going to tamper with her voice too much. I might just try and help it get embedded in the rest of the mix, but I don't want to make it super glitchy and super distorted, because that's not the way Norah recorded her track in the studio. So usually I'll leave the faces alone for the most part, the singers alone for the most part. And sometimes that singer is a violin. Sometimes that singer is quote unquote a bass line, et cetera, et cetera. So for those instances, I will put my own flavor on them, or maybe articulate them in a way that's endemic to my production. But for the most part, I will try and leave the face alone, and I will build the groove in a complementary way around their existing face.
That's terrific. I know I've done some remix competitions in the past, and I've tried to leave the vocalist alone. And one of the things that I've discovered that's an upshot of that that's nice is that if the, you know, if you use, if you build all of your original sounds around the vocal, you wind up with this very nice remix. But then if for some reason you don't have permission to use the vocal and you don't win the remix competition, you can just strip the vocal out of there and hire somebody else to do another top line for you, and you've got a finished track you can release.
That's a great idea.
So it's a great workflow.
I was going to also just say, while we're talking about remixes, I find some of the best uses of my time are the arrangement exercise. And I don't know if your listeners are too familiar with the arrangement exercise. It's basically where you deconstruct a track, every component of a track, using empty MIDI clips. Underneath that track, you'll place exactly where your kick, or where the kick of the reference track is, using an empty MIDI clip. And then you'll go through it again, and you'll do the same for the snare. And then you'll go through it again and do the same for the sub, and then the top bass, and then the effects, and then the chords, et cetera, et cetera. And you basically have an empty MIDI clip version of their song below the original reference track. I regularly find myself doing that. That's an extremely useful way of learning how to visualize and arrange electronic music, which always sounds so, when you listen to electronic music late at night in the club, it always sounds so simple and it sounds so elegant. And you listen to it and you're like, hey, I could go back home and I could make this right now. And then you sit down, you try, and it's much harder than you would have originally given yourself credit for. So I find that when I do the arrangement exercise, and I try and do that at least twice a week, it'll often be a little bit more than that. That it helps fill in my understanding of the visual symmetry of what electronic music is supposed to look like and the way that it is arranged. And so the same is true with remixes. Even if I don't release a remix, or even if I don't have permission to release the vocals from that remix like you were talking about, I will still gain so much from deconstructing every single stem and seeing how these pros that I'm emulating are doing their fills. We're seeing how exactly they're doing their buildups and their false drops. Very often, false drops are kind of confusing to listen to, because they're not confusing to listen to. They're really simple to listen to and they make so much sense. But then when you go and you try and do your own kind of false drop, whereby the drop doesn't land until, you know, either bar three or bar four of after the downbeat of the drop moment, that stuff can be really confusing to try and do without a reference track. So whenever I'm doing stem remixes and I'm able to analyze and deconstruct how others are doing those kinds of things, it's a total educational opportunity that has made me a lot stronger as a producer. So I would encourage you to do remixes, even if you're not allowed, or if you're not allowed to release them.
You've talked in the past importance of listening to music outside of the genre you're producing in. Do you think there's value in also doing the arrangement exercise for tracks that are not in the genre you're producing in?
Oh, that's a great question. Honestly, I'm sure there is value, but it might not be value as it pertains to what you want to do. You have to link up specifically your goals, your targets, where you want to go, and your demographic with the kinds of exercises that you're doing. If you're always deconstructing, you know, Fela Kuti, you might be really excellent at making that kind of like Afropop. You might be really good at making that kind of music, but that might not necessarily help you make and execute house music. So I would say that at least for the remixes that you do, obviously diversity is everything in life. You need a lot of different stimuli to grow as a person. So by getting out of your comfort comfortable genre and engaging with something that you're not used to engaging with, you are going to grow that way, but it might not directly get you on your path towards your goals. So for me, I tend to kind of stay within electronic music when I'm doing arrangement exercises, although I have just started a Modest Mouse remix, and I think that that could be really useful for me to do some Modest Mouse arrangement exercises and kind of break down how Isaac Brock has been putting together his music for, you know, 20 plus years. So it's kind of whatever serves your values and serves your interests.
Okay, great. So moving back from remixes to producing original tracks, talk to me about your Wales track that just came out on the Animalia EP with Producer Dojo. How did awesome. That come about yeah. and where did you start with that?
So that's a cool one. That is such a great idea for a Cypher release. And just so everyone is on the same page here, Kermode, who is a premier sensei over at the Producer Dojo, Kermode means spirit bear. Again, check him out. Fantastic producer. He was a guest curator for one of our Cyphers. And his idea for that month's Cypher was to create a song influenced by an animal. So that whole EP is based on different animal inspirations, like your spirit animal, just like Kermode means spirit bear. I am from Hawaii and have a very deep and abiding fear of the ocean, but I have a massive, massive respect for the ocean. And I'm sure you can see, I mean, anyone who's paying attention understands how important the ocean is to the planet's ecological balance. And so I wanted to do something that was big and immense and deep like the ocean. And that was kind of what I was going for. And I was like, okay, well, the perfect animal that, you know, would work for this cipher would be a whale, because whales have whale song. It's already a thing that has tone, it has music, it's really beautiful and could be listened to on its own. So I was like, what if I just put a beat behind whale singing? Would I be able to make that work? And no, it didn't work at all, because whale singing has no key and it's super, super strange sounding sometimes, and it doesn't really follow a beat. So instead, what I did is I took the whale song, I threw it into a sampler, and I processed it and transformed it into keys, and basically made certain whale singing in key with my song, and ended up using that. But the raw whale song didn't work itself, which is fine. And then I built a beat around kind of around that original idea. But it was hard to find a face for that song, because other than the whale singing, what I really wanted was something that felt kind of like cold and migratory. And I know that whales, you know, they will swim from the Alaska to the South Pole over the course of a year. And they very regularly go right next to Hawaii, and they will stop and rear their calves in Hawaii. So I needed something that would be like immense. I wanted there to be something that had a level of like scale and immensity to it. So I wrote like a longer track than I would normally write. I tried to do a really big drop to have that sense of depth. And then as for this cold kind of face, I did like a very plucky kind of lead synth sound that was using like a cold minor key tonality to try and make it feel like, you know, this is an Arctic kind of vibe. So I don't know if I achieved that, but I've gotten good reviews on the track. So I think some people have liked it, but it was definitely a challenge and it was really fun. And I found the exercise of trying to imagine these adjectives, these animalistic kind of adjectives, and let them inform the music, ended up being a really, really useful exercise that I would definitely employ again in the future. And what I mean is like using these adjectives of like immense, big, deep, et cetera, ocean adjectives. I felt that that kind of helped inform the decisions that I was making, and it gave me some constraints. I think that so many people often get paralyzed in front of Ableton because there is so much open in front of you. And so by actively restricting some of your possibilities by confining yourself to a box, like the box of genre or the box of a key, following a certain key is putting yourself into a constraint. It's putting yourself into a box that actually that actually frees up a lot more creative potential, because you have to find creative ways to get around your obstacles, and you have to find creative ways to conform to your obstacles. So I'm a big believer in following certain rules with electronic music, or just with music in general. I get a lot of students who very much want to push the envelope and they want to break all the rules. And I encourage that. That's cool. That's great. But you can't really break those rules until you understand them intuitively. And so the joke that I always make with my students is like, if you are going to break all the rules and you're going to try and make a dance track without a kick, very good chances you're not making dance music. So by breaking that rule and taking the kick out, you are not going to be creating dance music. So just follow that rule. It's that easy. Just have a kick in your track. So that's like a very basic rule. But for me in this particular track, Whales, by not just having this set of rules, okay, I'm going to have a kick, I'm going to have a snare, okay, I'm going to use the Western scale, okay, I'm going to follow those very basic rules, some of these other adjectives help constrain my creative decisions. I needed sounds that sounded cold. I needed sounds that sounded deep. I needed sounds that sounded immense. When I had those kinds of creative limits on my choices, I think that the process helped get me there faster. So I actually wrote Whales on my way back from Japan. My girlfriend and I were leaving the country to go do a dog sit in Japan. This was like 2 or 3 weeks before COVID hit and shut down everything. It was the last time I was out of the country.
Wow.
And it was such a blessing that we were able to travel at that time, because if I had known that COVID was coming, I probably would have just stayed out of the country, as I'm sure you can imagine. Anyway, we were in Japan and on our way back, we got stuck in the airport in Guam for like 22 hours. And I had my computer on me and nothing to do. So I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll take a crack at this track. I have all these cool whale songs. Let me go ahead and try and write a beat and write a face. And it just kind of came out in that 22 hours because I made choices based on those adjectives that were constraining me. And I was happy with it for the most part. And I got in touch with a friend of mine who lives in California. He's also from Hawaii. He's a fantastic vocalist and rap producer. His name is Malay. Go check him out. M-E-L-L-A-Y. And we've worked together before. And I sent him the track. And I was just like, yo, dude, you think you could spit some words for this? We need to keep it slightly animalistic and slightly whaley. If you have anything in that theme, please don't hesitate to spit. And sure enough, he threw down a really catchy hook. And I was like, dude, okay, now I have a face. So I just compiled it, mixed it, and it was done. It took probably like a week to do the whole song.
I got to say, it's a remarkably diverse track. It's a genre defying track in my mind. You know,
well, thank you.
I listened to it starting off with whale tones. And then when the rapper comes in, I just thought, wow, this is different. I wasn't expecting that, but it's really cool. And I will definitely link that in the show notes so that my listeners can hear it. Talk about working with Malay. Was that just a matter of you gave him some guidance and some general ideas and, hey, can you sound like a whale? And then he sent you back stems, or how did that back and forth go?
So that's a really good conversation. Whenever you're working with vocalists, you want to meet the vocalist where they're at. As Malay is concerned, he is extremely talented. He's been doing this a long time. So less is always more from me. Whenever I just kind of back off and give him the creative reins, he will do all the work himself. And oftentimes my suggestions will kind of throw him off his groove. So I would rather just get out of the picture and just let him do it, send him the track, wait 2 weeks and he'll send me back some choices. And then I will be like, oh, I like this. Oh, I don't like this, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll narrow it down a little bit more. But other vocalists need a little bit more guidance. They need you to say things like, okay, that was a great performance, but you're kind of hitting a level 4 in energy, and I would like you to bring it up to a level 7 in energy. Can I get more diaphragm voice? Can I get a little bit more of a head voice as opposed to a chest voice? Maybe you can sing it like you're tiptoeing down the halls late at night. You know, sometimes direction is needed for certain vocalists. As Malay is concerned, my directing is honestly probably more harmful to the process than just letting him do his own thing. So Malay is great. I can just get out of the way and let him do all the work, and he will deliver a really professional product.
I like that quote, meet the vocalist where they are.
Precisely, yeah.
You brought up Japan. We got to talk about Japan. What took you to Japan, and how long were you there, and did you do anything DJ production related while you were there? Was that just touring?
Great question. No, I didn't do anything music. That was a little getaway, as a matter of fact. So a few years ago, my partner and I were living in Southeast Asia, and we heard from other travelers that there's this website that's called WorkAway. Oh, I'm sorry. This is a different website. Actually, pardon me. We heard about this thing called housesitters.com, which you pay basically or it's actually trustedhousesitters.com. That's what it's called. And you pay $80 a year or something to join this website. They do a background check. And then once you're cleared with the background check, you're able to join all sorts of communities worldwide that are searching for a trusted house sitter to either watch their house or watch their pet for a specified number of days. And we happened to, we were living when we came back from New Zealand and when we came back from Southeast Asia, we're like, you know what, let's keep doing this because it's fun. It's great to go and live in other people's lives for a couple of days and to take care of their animals. We're both animal lovers and we both love to travel. So we signed up for one of those to go do a house sit in Japan and we're able to get away for a weekend and go do that. Admittedly, as well, Japan isn't that far from Hawaii. So it's a lot closer for us than it would be for people on the mainland.
That makes sense. What part of Japan were you in?
So we were in Kyoto.
Oh, wow. The old city.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was my first time there. I'd only ever, a few years ago with my father, we went to Mount Fuji and we spent some time in Tokyo and then we climbed Mount Fuji, which was profound, super spiritual, super dope. I really recommend it. It's an incredible hike. But that was really my only dipping my toes into Japan. And so this other time going with my partner, Karina, we were able to have some nightlife and hang out in a Japanese house, in a traditional Japanese house, and go to Japanese restaurants and be very much more immersed in the day-to-day life of Japan. So that was a completely different experience, but really, really nice. And like I said, 2 weeks before COVID, so we got back and we were like, oh, well, where should we go next? And then sure enough, Americans aren't welcome anywhere anymore.
Yeah, you guys cut it close. The last time I was in Japan, I was super impressed with the modern Japanese, how they're incredibly, incredibly clean and safe, the cities. Yes. I was in Tokyo and Kyoto. I was there for 3 weeks and I saw only one piece of trash on the streets. Mm-hmm. That was it. And it absolutely astounded me. And then I came back to the States and, you know, there's trash discarded everywhere. You know, it's absolutely just commonplace. And it just kind of blew my mind. The other thing that strikes me in retrospect as interesting was the number of people, even back then, masks were a, you know, fashion statement. At every metro stop, you know, there were places where you could buy masks that were after pop artists or particular fashions or whatnot. And, you know, masks were just very commonplace and there was no political element to it. It was just everybody wears them. And I imagine that served them well.
They have an extremely dense population, most East Asian countries, South mm-hmm. as well, Southeast Asian countries as well. And so when SARS hit in 2001, they didn't take any chances then. And mask wearing has since been commonplace since 2001, to my understanding. I've spent quite a bit of time in China, Vietnam, Thailand, other Southeast Asian countries, and a little bit in Japan. And I think that it's like you're saying, particularly countries like Japan and Singapore, these very developed Eastern nations, the fact that they treat their land so well and take care of their land so well and everything is clean and safe, to me, that exemplifies real patriotism. I think that you can claim to be a patriot when you are picking up cigarette butts. And now that ties into my own personal kind of Hawaiian background. I'm not Hawaiian, but from being from Hawaii, but that ties into being just in touch with the land from Hawaii. Is there is a sense of environmentalism and a sense of patriotism to care about the land that you're from. And so I think it's our duty to just look out for ourselves, look out for our future, and look out for the land itself by taking care of it and not treating it like, you know, it's a hotel room or some discardable piece of garbage that we can just mess up and get away with. So I definitely like that about Japan as well. They take really good care of it and it does feel like a really safe place. Admittedly, I didn't have any run-ins with the Yakuza or your former masters. So
yeah, they tend to stay in the shadows, but
I would
it
imagine.
Was interesting. I did a Japanese bathhouse. I don't have any tattoos. And that was a very unique experience. I was glad I did not have any tattoos because you're not allowed to go to the traditional houses if you have tattoos because they are concerned about Yakuza. So it remains a concern today. Although, as you said, it's remarkably safe. In Tokyo, in New York City, you would never veer off down a dark alleyway. But in Tokyo, all the interesting stuff is down the dark alleyways, and never once felt unsafe. So yeah, really cool. I can't wait to go back.
Cool. I hope you get to soon. I hope you get to go on tour there. You know, that would be, it would be great to bring your music to them and learn some of their music for yourself. Like they, the electronic scenes or the music scene as a whole in Asia is similar, but also very different. Oh, my dog is going crazy right now. Give her a second. She should be quiet. Of course, I told her that I had a podcast, but she's just so disrespectful. Anyway, what I was saying is that when we were in Southeast Asia and in Vietnam in particular, there's electronic music everywhere. I was blown away at how absolutely prevalent it was. And I'm not talking like just in clubs. I'm talking like every restaurant has DJs. Plenty of resorts have DJs. It's just really, really prevalent. So I know that there's a huge market for it, especially in Thailand and Vietnam, where you have lots of Western tourists coming in to party. So you could guaranteed make a tour work for you there. And then I would imagine that Japan has a similar kind of scene, but I didn't quite discover that. And I would like to go back and really try and look for it when I'm there next.
Yeah, that is absolutely a goal of mine to do an international tour. And the only thing is I want to do it as an independent artist. I don't want to do it with a big label because from what I understand, the tours with big labels are very intensive. It is, you know, bam, 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 stop, stop, stop. And I would want to, you know, do the touristy thing. Even if the tour didn't make a lot of money or even broke even, if it could fund my tourism, that would be all good.
Yeah. That's the goal, I think, is to just be able to travel for free or to be paid to travel. If you don't have to spend the money to travel, you are so far ahead in the race of traveling anyway. I think that's always the most prohibitive aspect of traveling is that it's very expensive. And so a lot of people, they tell themselves, oh, I could never do that. But really, like once you get out there, once you take the leap and take the plunge, you're able to make ends meet a lot more than you would expect, especially like I was saying earlier with websites like Trusted House Sitters or workaway.com, you can go travel quite easily on a traveler's budget. And it's not wholly prohibitive. So for me, my goal is exactly the same, Brian, that I basically want to just be able to be paid to travel. I love to do that. And if I could also share music and be paid to do that while I'm traveling, that's my dream entirely and wholly. So that's, of course, a long-term goal. And to get to the long-term goals, you need to have the short and the midterm goals, which make them far more achievable. But that is my long-term goal, essentially.
One of the things that I listened to a lot of podcasts, not surprisingly, and there was another artist that I was listening to, and this gentleman, he produces kind of meditative music, and he runs these workshops where he tours around, he drums up a crowd by using targeted Facebook ads, but mm-hmm. he toured Europe with him and his family on this sort of meditation tour and did quite well. It strikes me, you are a remarkable teacher. I haven't had the pleasure of a lesson from you yet, but listening to you on other podcasts and here, you have a very, very, you are very good at explaining complex topics simply.
Well, thank you.
And so maybe something that you could do would be combine your music with also, hey, I'm going to run a workshop at the end of this. If you want to learn how to make stuff like this, that might be a way to sort of upsell and make a little extra money and help to fund the tour in addition as you're out there anyway.
That's a fantastic idea and definitely something I'd love to get into. I sometimes worry, you know, straight talk right now, real talk right now. I sometimes worry that I'm a better teacher than I am a producer. That's like a personal insecurity of mine. It's like, should I like just be teaching this stuff? Because ultimately, I want to shift out of teaching entirely. I would much rather be just a professional producer than a professional teacher of production, which is kind of what I am now. All my income comes from teaching, which is, you know, it's cool, but I'd much rather be playing shows. But yeah, that is a great idea. And I would love to leverage teaching to get some, to supplement the tour income as well.
Well, it seems like they're mutually reinforcing, you know, the better a producer you are, the more you can command and maybe the less you need to teach. You know, if you had Skrillex teaching a weekend workshop, you know, he could command thousands of dollars per head, whereas you or I, you know, maybe a few hundred. So
mm-hmm. It's definitely true. I find too that with teaching, when I I very often bump into my own blind spots. And I did this, especially at the beginning of teaching for the dojo. And I was like, oh my goodness, there's so many things that I thought I knew that I don't know as well as I did. So I have to go and like, to learn how to explain something, you have to go internalize that lesson in the first place. So before I could even express how people can learn, I needed to learn what I didn't know and discover my own blind spots. So that was really a really educational process for myself. And being a teacher has definitely made me a better producer. At the same time, though, like, you know, I was a teacher for a long time before I was a producer, and I would definitely like to leave that aspect of the profession and just enter the performative aspect entirely. But one of these days, one day at a time.
Got it. So that's probably a good transition to, you know, right now, very few people are performing in person. And, you know, I would certainly argue that performing in person is in most places a little questionable ethically right now with the pandemic out there. So a lot of producers have shifted and DJs have shifted to live streaming. And I know you've got a live stream coming up November 3rd. That's pretty unique. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So yes, that's going to be a live stream for the I Voted Festival, which is the largest online festival ever held. There's more than 600 artists over the course of the entire festival. And to get access to that, all you have to do is demonstrate that you have voted. So they request or are going to vote. So they basically request a picture of you with your ballot and then like a personal pledge that you're going to turn that ballot in. It would be a shame if you filled out that ballot and then just left it on your kitchen table. So I would imagine that most people are going to do that, but then you get access to this festival. There's something like 17 or 18 dojoites participating, which is cool. And then also Ill Gates himself, as well as hundreds and hundreds of other acts from all over the country. So I think it's going to be a really good turnout. I'm really excited to be a part of it. I built a set like specifically for that, which is very focused on my new upcoming EP. So it's much more down-tempo. It's not super dubsteppy. It's a lot of soul fusion and the niche that I've been occupying more and more the last few months has been sexadelic music. I'm trying to make music that is both sexy but also psychedelic. So sexadelic is kind of what this set is fully encompassing and explores. So please check it out. It's going to be really smooth. It's going to be really sensual. And so definitely go check that out.
Is that the title of the EP?
No, the title of the EP is actually Neo Eon Soul. Soul for the Neo Eon, Soul for the New Era. That's what it's going to be. Three big words of three big letters each. Soul is spelled S-O-L. So Neo Eon Soul. And you can look for that in December.
Awesome. All right. Well, congratulations. That's is that going to be four tracks?
I'm thinking more like seven, possibly eight, depending on the finalization of this last track. It's very, very, very close to being busted out right now. I just got another round of feedback from Dylan from Ill Gates, and that was illuminating and also a little bit discouraging, as his feedback always is. It's the best feedback you'll ever get, but it's also sometimes exactly the feedback that you need. Actually, no. It's always the feedback that you need. Sometimes it's the feedback that you don't really want because it means you have to work some more. So I got that back a few weeks ago, and I've just been tweaking up the final touches here, and I'm really looking forward to a bigger release.
Now, are you going to, so you're going to play some of the pieces from that during the November 3rd? You're going to tease those a little bit?
Oh, yes. There's most of that set is compiled of the new EP. So it'll be, it's going to be a grand debut. I'm really excited for it. A lot of vocalists on this EP, I've cultivated a lot of my sound over the last year, and I've really kind of solidified my sound and where I'm comfortable producing. So it's going to be very, I would like to say, mature. I mean, again, I don't want to come off as conceited. I don't want to pat myself on the back, but this new EP is definitely the thing I'm the most proud of as far as my artistic career goes, because it's, it's just very, I'm very comfortable with what I'm doing these days. It's no longer like I'm learning what I'm doing as I'm doing it. I know what I'm doing. I know how to reach for something and affect that which I reach for. So I'm very excited for this. I think I'm going to be really proud of it, I think. So that's all I mean to say.
Fantastic. Well, I can't wait to hear it. What are you doing to market that aside from appearing on podcasts like this one?
Absolutely. Yes. Honestly, not as much as I need to be. I'm still getting all these tweaks done. Once everything is mastered and already up on Spotify and we have the release date scheduled, I'll begin a massive campaign push, you know, Facebook targeted advertising, reach out to my large email list and try and get people to share it. I have a few other friends in the podcast community that I can get a little bit of promotionals with. But ultimately, the best way to share your music is to just play it live. As you know, we can't be playing anything live because of the pandemic for a good reason. But at the same time, I think a concerted push of live streams and a concerted outreach for other people to play certain songs on their live streams, that could be that's a one avenue. So I'm going to do a variety of things and also be in touch with the Dojo promotional team and see what they recommend and have on offer for me as well.
Okay, fantastic. So if people want to get in contact with you or follow you on your socials, what's the best place for people to reach out to you, Chris?
So if people would like to email me, I'm cryptochronica@gmail.com. So that's bookings or anything that is, you know, even if you just want to say what up, say hi, go ahead. Don't hesitate to shoot an email out to me. I'm always happy to meet new people. That is so much of what we're in this for, is to, you know, share a bit of ourselves and share our art with others. So if those others want to share something about them with me, I would love to meet you. Please, please reach out. And then on SoundCloud, Spotify, I'm Cryptochronica, just CRYPTO, crypto, and then Chronica, like chronic, but with an A. So CHRONIC with an A at the end, Cryptochronica. So come check me out on any of those things. I'm on Twitter, Instagram. But truth be told, I don't engage too much with those. A lot of people have said, like, a lot of professional performers have been really bummed because of COVID, because they're indoors now and they're not touring. Admittedly, we've seen a market pay decrease in all of our incomes. That said, I'm really enjoying the time that I'm having in the studio and the time that I'm having to produce and to hone my craft. So I'm honestly quite happy being in front of the computer screen practicing and getting better at production. So
yeah, that's probably the best possible way you can spend your time right now.
I think so as well. And just like you, you know, you're putting on something every week. You brighten my day every single time I open up Instagram and I see a new upload from you. So keep on doing what you're doing, House Ninja. I love it. I love it. I love it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And I really appreciate you coming on the podcast, and good luck with the EP. I will have to sign up for a lesson with you at some point. I appreciate everything you're doing.
Sweet, man. This has been a great time. Thanks for having me, and I hope to be on again somewhere in the future.
Sounds great. I'd enjoy that. Thanks, Chris.
All right.
Here were my biggest takeaways. First, when remixing, be careful not to mess too much with the face of a song. That's the defining vocal or instrumental element. Change it too much and you lose the character of the song. Second, try composing some of your rhythms with your mouth instead of your mouse. Learn a little bit of beatboxing, and it can help you to identify grooves and fills. Third, do more of the arrangement exercise, which involves breaking down tracks of other artists you admire to figure out when instruments enter and exit. A good way to do this is to use empty audio or MIDI clips to mark locations in the song. Fourth, constraints and rules can help to foster creativity. And finally, fifth, get to know your vocalists and meet them where they are. I hope you enjoyed this interview with Cryptochronica. If you know someone who would be a good fit for this podcast, please let me know. You can reach out to me at houseninjamusic@gmail.com. I've got a bunch of links for you in the show notes, so head over to producerlifepodcast.com and check out episode 44. If you're enjoying this podcast, it would be awesome if you would take a moment to leave a rating and review wherever you're listening. The algorithms love it when you do that, and it would help me to reach more listeners. Thank you so much. Until next week, this is the House Ninja, reminding you to be someone's hero today.